This morning, I'll be commenting on two short paragraphs from Martin Heidegger's Being and Time. Now, I know it would be more traditional to offer commentaries on Dogen Shoba Genzo, but I'm sure you'll find these passages just as esoteric and obscure as anything in Dogen. So if you like, when I read them, just imagine to yourself that you're listening to the Shobo Genzo, and I think it'll work out just fine. What the two have in common, as I hope you'll hear, is a concern with non-separation. In these passages, Heidegger uses this unusual word, Dasein, which doesn't get translated, where we might expect him to be talking about an individual or a person. But Dasein is his way of talking about that we exist. Dasein literally means being there, that we exist always in context, in relation. Our being is always being with. The world of Dasein is a with world. Being in is being with. The interworldly being in itself of others is Dasein with. Others are not encountered by grasping and discriminating beforehand one's own subject, initially objectively present, from other subjects already present. They are not encountered by first looking at oneself and then ascertaining the opposite pole of a distinction. They are encountered from out of the world in which Dasein, heedful and circumspect, essentially dwells. As opposed to the theoretically concocted explanation of the presence of others, which easily urge themselves upon us, we must hold fast to the phenomenal fact which we have pointed out, namely that they are encountered in the surrounding world. This nearest and elemental way of Dasein encountering the world goes so far that even one's own Dasein initially becomes discoverable by looking away from its own experiences and the center of its actions, or by not yet seeing them at all. Dasein initially finds itself in what it does, needs, expects, has charge of, in the things at hand, which it initially takes care of in the surrounding world. Here's the second passage. According to the analysis which we have now completed, being with others belongs to the being of Dasein, with which it is concerned in its very being. As being with, Dasein is essentially for the sake of others. This must be understood as an existential statement as to its essence. But even when actual Dasein does not turn to others and thinks it does not need them or does without them, it is still in the mode of being with. In being with as the existential for the sake of others, these others are already disclosed in their Dasein. this previously constituted disclosedness of others, together with being with, thus helps to constitute significance, that is, worldliness. As this worldliness, disclosedness, is anchored in the existential for the sake of which, hence the worldliness of the world thus constituted, in which Dasein always already essentially is, lets things at hand be encountered in the surrounding world in such a way that the Dasein with of others is encountered at the same time with them as circumspectly taken care of. The structure of the worldliness of the world is such that others are not initially present as unattached subjects along with other things, but show themselves in their heedful being in the surrounding world in terms of the things at hand in that world. The therapists in the group might connect to these passages via Winnicott's famous saying, "There's no such thing as a baby." By that he meant babies are never found in isolation from mothers. They only exist because there are mothers. That what a baby is logically connected to what mothers are, and they are found together in the world. So Heidegger, in his own esoteric way, is trying to describe a world of non-separation. In terms of what we are, is always a matter of what we're connected to, who we're connected to, what we care about, who we're concerned with, and what we do about these things. He uses care in a particular way that can mean taken care of, but also has a much broader sense of what matters to us. And when Heidegger talks about the worldliness of our world, basically he's trying to talk about how our world is defined by what matters to us. And we live in a kind of bubble of mattering that has distinct contours and boundaries. And it has limits according to what matters and what doesn't matter. There was a famous paper in neurophysiology by Barella and Maturana called "What the Frog's Eye Tells the Frog's Brain," in which they basically determine that the frog's eye is built in such a way as to be a movement detector. It's very good at seeing objects move across a stable background. In other words, a fly detector, right? When one of these small object is moving across a stationary background, a reflex happens and the tongue goes out, it grabs the fly. But what that means is that the frog's world is in this sense defined and limited to what matters to it. It literally only sees what matters. It doesn't have an eye capable of discerning fine details of stationary objects. It doesn't need to see those things, and it doesn't. So Heidegger says our world is defined by who we are concerned with and the things we care for. And in his particular way of looking at things, like the frog, we're largely born into those conditions. He says we're thrown into a world. We find ourselves in the midst of life, in the midst of a particular culture. And it's largely a given what matters to us. He says we have to learn to recognize both the givenness and the arbitrariness of those cultural givens. And we can see that taking place culturally in all sorts of ways in which we may grow up caring about or having matter only our immediate family or the people in our neighborhood or the people who we think of as like us. And that there are all sorts of ways in which the vast majority of the people of the world are othered. In a large sense, we sort of vaguely intellectually know they're out there, but they don't matter in the sense that we don't take their life or needs or suffering with anything like the urgency we would feel if it was happening to the people close at hand that mattered to us. Now, I'd like to suggest that this is a pretty good metaphorical explanation of what we mean by a self-centered dream. By being self-centered, we exist in a circumscribed world of what we care about and what matters to us. And we're oblivious to everything outside the boundary of that bubble. We may be oblivious to the suffering of others, and we may be oblivious literally to the things at hand, the objects in our world that we overlook or treat as if they don't matter. Joko sort of famously cared about whether her students put things away carefully or not. There was behind the zendo in the yard a set of tables and chairs where people might sit during breaks. She always looked to see, after you sat at that table, did you put the chair back where it was beforehand, or did you just leave the chair out sort of at any old angle, oblivious to whether it was arranged properly or not? When you had a cup of tea, did you just leave it in the sink for assuming somebody else was going to wash it? Or did you rinse it yourself and put it away? In part, Zen can be thought of as a practice which increases the circle of the things we're concerned about and the circle of things we take care of. Zen is about, whether the bed gets made, whether the cap gets put back on the tube of toothpaste, or on the top of the bottle of olive oil, whether the dishes are washed and put away or left in the sink. And as Heidegger says, if we want to know who we are, we find that out not by some act of deep introspection, but by looking at what we do, looking outside. See, again, it's part of the self-centered dream to define ourselves solely in terms of our thoughts and our feelings, solely in terms of things taking place inside our head or inside our own body. That's who I really am. But I think Joko would agree with Heidegger, who we are is as much whether we make the bed or not, and put the cap back on the toothpaste, as it is what I'm thinking about. Who I am is the quality of my interactions with my world. Who I am is the quality of my relationship to others. Now, one of the real distinctions between Zen and what we find in Heidegger is we have a notion of practice that he doesn't have. He wants to use philosophy to gain insight into the nature of things. He primarily thinks that it is awareness of death, of finitude, that has the possibility of waking us up to how we are in the world, waking us up to what matters and how we care for things. But it's not something that can be formalized into a practice or a discipline. In a way, it's the nature of both religion and psychotherapy that they have practices. They don't just have theories, they have practices. They're things that we do on a daily basis to foster our awareness of how we are in the world. And that's one of the reasons that over the years I've said I'm religious rather than spiritual, because I associate religious with religious practice. And spiritual often has the connotation of being preoccupied with particular special states of consciousness. But being religious or having a practice is about what we do. We find ourselves in discipline, in ritual, in the repetition, in the showing up that demonstrates to ourselves and others what kind of person we are, what we care about, who we're concerned with, and how we handle all of these people and things in our world. It is through care and concern that we push the boundaries or break through the bubble of the self-centered dream, which is only concerned with what kind of experience am I having on the cushion today? How am I feeling? Is it the way I want to feel? Am I doing it right? Am I doing it wrong? to move out of that is to see us as all participating in something together, where what we're doing matters to everyone else here, supports and co-creates this Sangha in which practice can happen. If I bring in something seemingly from left field like Heidegger, it's just trying to shake up our usual expectations or picture of what Buddhism is and what practice is. Practice shouldn't just take place in a Buddhist bubble, right? Where we associate it only with the few authors that we're used to reading and hearing quoted over and over and over again until they become commonplace. I think the more we hear echoes of Buddhism, whether it's in Whitman or in Heidegger, the more we allow our sense of practice to permeate every aspect of our life, from our reading to whether or not we've made the bed this morning.